Blog Talk Radio.
Oh my God, oh my God, to quote South Park, this is Dr. John Singh from Studio G in Greenville, South Carolina. It is none other than pop culture stars. In our fifth year and going strong into our sixth year soon, it's great to have everybody with us. We've got everybody, but of course the queen of Sparkle. She is out on special assignment. We're still glad to have her part of us. First of all, I want to say thank you to my number one bro, Dave Atwell, the author, for running the board tonight. Dave Atwell, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing very well out here getting ready to enjoy another fantastic cigar from Godfather Cigars here in Jacksonville. And as I was talking in the green room, I'm trying this new technique for lighting it to see if I get a better flavor out of it. So in the event you hear any gurgle screams, that's me burning my hand as I go to cut this thing. So
you're ridiculous, Dave, but we couldn't see.
And just wait for the ambulance to pull up. But no, otherwise, having a good night. Looking forward to tonight's show.
From the northernmost outpost, Indianapolis, Indiana, the home of the Brickyard 400, the one and only, what's your name again?
Bond. James Bond.
John, how you doing, buddy? That was a joke.
Hey,
how you doing tonight, Todd?
This is Todd, and you know, I am outstanding, the supernatural, and ecstatic to be here. We have had three mornings in a row that I have not had to go outside and scrape the windshield and spend an extensive amount of time warming up the motor vehicle. It is, man, we're hitting the tail end of winter. I mean, it's going to try to give us a bit of a grip on Friday, but, man, it is beautiful. We have hit 50s and all kinds of craziness. And check this out. The sun has broken through four out of 7 days this last week. That is something else.
Okay, well,
we don't have that
in Salem, I'll tell you that. Amazing. Happy for you.
We're about to float off out here in Alabama.
Now be careful. Don't talk until you're introduced. The one and only Kevin Holland from The Walking Dead in our southernmost outpost in Birmingham, Alabama. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Oh, I'm here. I didn't mean to cut in.
You can cut in anytime you want. I like to yell. I like to yell at people, and this is the only show that I can yell at everybody, and they can yell back at me. Okay, so anyway, we are glad to have you. You're one of the meanest men on camera, and one of the coolest people I've ever talked to. So we're just glad to have you, and you've got a bunch of projects you're working on, and this and that, and this and that. And I'll just go ahead and announce you are going to be the narrator / host of the new Lizard Man documentary being filmed in Bishopville, South Carolina, in about a month and a half or 2 months or something like that. So we're glad to have you here. And tell us the most important thing that you can tell us tonight. A horrible
man,
question.
Just stay positive. I've gotten so much from just a positive attitude, man. And y'all, you know, being on the show last week gave me a little bit of inspiration. It gave me some fuel for thought. And I'm just, you know, I'm excited to be back. And just stay positive.
Well, that's great. Dave, it's hard for me to believe you gave someone some positive mental attitude, but I bet you did. And Todd, same thing with you. You guys are great, and it's good to have a new guy with us, and we're going to have a marvelous time. And I will tell everybody that today I had a wonderful thing happen. I was interviewed WSPA, Channel 7, Greenville Spartanburg, about the Bigfoot Town Hall meeting in Clemson this weekend. It's going to be a blast. And they asked me back because we're going to be moving, or not moving, but we're going to be expanding the Lizard Man Festival scene from just Bishopville up to Easley, South Carolina, which is part of Greenville, South Carolina, and it's going to be a blast. And those folks, they wrote their names, they wrote their phone numbers, their emails. They said, send us some posters, send us some Lizard Man stuff. I said, heck yeah. So we got some new friends, and I told them all about the podcast, and they said, yeah, well, maybe we'll be on there. I said, so we might have some new guests, WSPA Channel 7, Greenville Spartanburg, nice people. So I'll let everybody know when they're going to be coming on. Anyway, tonight, one of the men that has absolutely, I mean absolutely, shaped America, one of the greatest entrepreneurs in the history of the world, is with us. Dave, do you know who that might be?
I got a sneaking suspicion, but I don't want to blow it for everybody, so I'll just go ahead and fly a kite and lightning storm. How's that?
I can tell you, it could be shocking.
You might have to eat an apple.
Tonight, one of the best people who impersonates and actually is part of the spirit of Benjamin Franklin, Bill Pacer from Raleigh, North Carolina. Bill, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. It's Dr. Benjamin Franklin, please. I'm one of the greatest men, greatest thinkers, greatest philosophers in the world, and I'm very humble also.
All right, Mr. Franklin.
Very humble and modest.
Here's the first question I have for you. Tell us how your great man, and by the way, Bill doesn't know what I'm going to be asking him, but he is, let's say, he's truly an expert on the spirit of Ben Franklin. Bill, what are the great things that you have done that have positively influenced this country?
To be honest,
we got somebody doing dishes or what?
I think the Great Compromise. What do you do? So why is the Great Compromise? That's doing a House and Senate. The smaller states were not going to the Constitutional Convention because it was going to be just one House, the House of Representatives. And you knew that the large states were in control of what was happening. And the smaller states would have no control. He devised the idea of two members in the Senate, that all laws had to be passed by both. And what happened was, when he devised the House and the Senate, he was not very popular. There was a lot of jealousy involved. So what he did is he went to Roger Sherman and John Dickinson and said, here's my idea. Will you introduce it? Not tell them. And when those two gentlemen introduced it, it was met with great welcoming, and it was passed. If they had known that Franklin had devised it, it would never have passed.
Okay. Now I've got two questions I want to ask you. And you can answer them both simultaneously or one after another. Number one, why did you never run for president? And number two, why did you become the first millionaire in the free world, in the new world?
All right, well, running for president, George Washington was the only nominee. And he was quite clear, better for it. At the time, Franklin was very ill. Was very ill, and so George Washington wanted hands without any opposition, and Franklin just couldn't because he was too ill. Now I will say one thing. One day, people forget, that probably the most important date in the history of the world. March 4th, 1787.
Tell us about it.
It was the date when George Washington went to the Congress and said, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. That's when John Adams took office as president and Thomas Jefferson became vice president. The first time ever a popularly elected leader took over from another popularly elected leader without bloodshed, without rancor, very peaceful. And that's the great thing about this country. For over 250 years, it's been a peaceful transition of power. I mean, whether they like people or not, the president has taken over. Every 4 years, there's an election. And it's always been a peaceful transition of power. They may not have liked who was elected, but it's always been a peaceful transition.
Okay.
That's something no other nation can say. I mean, every 4 years, England has had a bit of parliamentary. This is where the people are electing their leader. And it's peaceful transition of power. And the rich man, I worked hard. Franklin worked hard. I keep on saying Franklin worked very hard. He became the richest self-made man in the world. Well, here's the thing. At the age of 17, he walked into Philadelphia with barely a farthing in his pocket. At the age of 42, he retired. He spent the next 42 years of his life doing good for the people of the country. Doing good for man is doing good for God. And he did that very well. And he dedicated himself to making a lot of the people as better as he could. And yes, he made mistakes, and he admits them. But it was always in the idea of what was best for the country, not what was best for some politician or some lobbyist or some business.
All right. Well, now, Bill, Mr. Franklin, you mentioned a particular date. It was March the 4th in what year?
1797.
Well, sir, what is today's date?
March 4th.
Yes, sir. So congratulations, Mr. Franklin, on everything that you've done. That's what I
didn't even realize about the date until you mentioned.
That's right. You did a great. Pardon my grammar. You did a great damn job. You absolutely.
Thank you.
You rocked. And you really did. And that's why we put your face on the $100 bill. And that's why we put you on the Franklin half dollar in 1948 to 1963. And we appreciate everything you've done. Your principles have guided us. Your principles of entrepreneurship and your principles of finance have guided those of us that have listened to you, because if we didn't listen to you, we wouldn't know what the hell we were going to do. So now I want to ask my esteemed panel of Dave, Todd, and Kevin, in that order, ask Mr. Franklin an important question. Because his advice, Bill Pacer, who plays Benjamin Franklin all the time, who has studied him, has great advice for us channeled from Benjamin Franklin. Mr. Atwell, what question do you have for Mr. Franklin through Mr. Pacer?
Well, I've always considered Franklin, Jefferson, and Madison as being three of the, you know, Washington did his contributions on the battlefield, and, you know, Adams did his through the courts and all that kind of stuff. But I always, in my opinion, felt that Franklin, Jefferson, and Madison were the three guys who did a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes down to the documentation and the structuring of what we, you know, created as a country. So what kind of relationship did you have with those two men? Was it a positive one, or was it more of a contentious one like Jefferson and Adams had?
Well, ours was very positive. Jefferson and I were very good. Jefferson and Franklin, forgive me if I start talking about I as Franklin. I do that sometimes. Jefferson and were very, very, very great. Very good friends. We worked together. We had great admiration for each other. When he when Jefferson came to relieve Franklin as ambassador to France, he knows that the ladies were rather friendly to me and fawned all over me and being upset that I was leaving. And he said, "Dr. Franklin, can you teach me how to get such admiration?" And I said, Mr. Jefferson, no, you're way too young." And the other one was somebody said, "Are you here to replace Dr. Franklin?" He says, "I am here to succeed him. No one can replace him."
Oh, wow. Nice.
I like it.
Well put, sir. Dave, thank you for that great question. Mr. Todd Saxon from our northernmost outpost in Indianapolis, what question do you have to Mr. Franklin?
Mr. Franklin, I do have a question.
Yeah.
You did some, one of your multiple inventions, actually, it's kind of funny, little thing I'm doing on the side here, as Mr. Edison and Mr. Tesla being involved. So your work in the sciences, bringing awareness of electricity to people, still impacting us today in many ways. It's more about how people happen to be without electricity for a moment. That they feel that today. You were big behind the whole electricity thing. But the most practical thing that I think you've done is when it comes to spectacles, or ye old bifocals. So what was your drive behind the sciences? Because, I mean, that's two major impacts today. And that's been a minute. So you're still impacting our lives today. So what was your drive behind the sciences to do that?
Simply, if I questioned something, if I couldn't understand it, I wanted to find out the answer. I wanted to try to tame electricity. I wanted to find a way to harness it. It was something we at that time no one knew, and I devised a plan to test it. And the funny thing about it is, two men in France tested my theory first, and I did it a month later, not knowing they'd already done it because of time and communication. And I said, "Gentlemen, you did the first. You deserve credit." And they said, no, doctor. No, sir. We did that test based on your writings. You deserve all the credit, sir." And Franklin got what they call the Copley Medal, which was the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in science. And it was the Copley Medal started about 1725, around there. And the best scientists in the world have been honored with that award. That award is still in existence. And Franklin got it in 1752 for his experiments with electricity. And as a matter of fact, one time, I thought I could cook a turkey with electricity. So I, on Christmas Day, 1750, I hooked some connections to the turkey and some other connections, and I put the switch and unfortunately cooked the wrong turkey. I got cooked. The turkey didn't. And it almost killed me. However, I soon found out what I did wrong, and that turkey was delicious.
Very well. Well, you know what? That might have been the first informal electric chair. Look at that, another one.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, people, you know that I wanted the turkey to be the national bird, not the eagle. The eagle is a scavenger.
Oh, yes.
Turkey is
I am aware of that, because most people are not aware. Of course, we see all the images, especially, at the White House, to take the turkeys there and get their pardon and all that. But if you've ever seen a wild turkey in action, that is a completely different beast.
Yeah, yes. That ain't no joke.
As a matter of fact, I can say that I used to live in North Georgia, and I had a pack of wild turkeys around my house. They seemed to congregate around my house, and I was well protected with these turkeys there. But I'll tell you one thing about the turkey. It wanted to be the national symbol, and in many aspects it is. Just look at Washington. It's full of turkeys.
You were more prescient than some people knew.
Yeah. Talk about a visionary. Yeah.
Kevin, you're up, brother. You got anything?
Yeah, man. I've been sitting back listening. I do have a question, actually. You know, I see where Benjamin Franklin has exceeded in so many things. I do have a question concerning what, in honest opinion, it would have to remain in opinion at this point because the time frame, but where do you think Benjamin Franklin, what could he have changed that would have made a difference that, you know, that became a possibility that we just wound up with a different outcome?
Well, first of all, the one thing when Congress had passed the Constitution, one of the ladies in Philadelphia asked him, "What have you gentlemen created, a monarchy or a republic?" And I retorted, "A republic, if you can keep it."
Yes.
Yeah. Well said.
And the thing is, my one thing is. I look at things, and it's all conjecture. But we look at the presidential campaigns over the past couple hundred years, and the elections. One thing that disturbs me, and I think would disturb Franklin, is that of the 45 presidents, I think 19, I think it was 18 or 19 of them, were elected. But less than 50% of the vote.
Yep.
John Quincy Adams was elected president. I'm talking about the popular vote now, not electoral college, but the popular vote. John Quincy Adams won the presidency with, I think, 28% of the vote.
Wow.
Abraham Lincoln won the presidency with less than 40% of the vote. I mean, one of the things that troubles me is that, well, electoral college is not, I'm not trying to get into that, but I believe the people should have a say. And the problem is, if you have a third or fourth party candidates, they diffuse the votes, and therefore many are elected president without 50%. My feeling is that we can have a damn runoff election for dog catcher. Should we have a runoff election for president?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
I'm digging the what is now an archaic reference about the runoff election for dog catcher, but yeah, I'm digging it because I hate to say it, when you're talking to most of the public today, you probably have to dumb that down, be more modern and come up. I don't know. You probably would have to have several lobotomies to be able to make it relate to the general public today. But yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
I used to edit a weekly newspaper, and I did it for a couple of years. And one thing I prided myself on, that people would come to me and say, "Do you believe in both sides?" I go, "No." They go, "What?" I believe in trying to put in all sides. So you have one side say ban, the other one says, you have the two extremes. Then most people are in the middle. So my thing was not to tell people how to think, but to give them all the information so they can make their own decision.
I agree with that.
I mean, being accurate, being factual. I mean, one time there was one politician who, frankly, I couldn't stand. I hated his guts. He hated mine. So it was mutual. But what I would do is when I'm putting a story together, I could, and especially a longer piece that's controversial, I would call them and say, here, I would be in the paragraph before, their paragraph, and the paragraph after. And I said, is this a correct quote? And almost every time, I was like, yes, it is. Thank you. One time I called, and he says, I called the guy, and he goes, is it a correct quote? I said, well, that's exactly what I said, but that's not what I meant. I said, what the fuck did you mean? I don't have time. What the fuck do you mean? And he said, and I said, okay, I'll fix it. This is what you, because you misstated, but I want to be fair to you. And some people say, well, I shouldn't have done that. But my thing is, I don't care about trying to find somebody. I mean, look, we you know, people like us, we talk a lot, and you have presidents, congressmen. You know, everything the president says, whether it's Obama, Trump, you know, Nixon, whatever, they say millions of words, and every once in a while they'd say something stupid. Is it because they're stupid? No, because they misstated, they're tired, whatever. And people would jump, hey, he said this. He said that 57 states. You know, he was tired. You know, don't go after him for one stupid, you know, misquote. And Donald Trump, he's famous for saying dumb stuff. Doesn't mean he's stupid. No, it doesn't mean he says a lot of words that sometimes get jumbled. Yeah, but anybody in that position will. And I really hate it when people go after somebody's one statement and mock them. I say, no. I mean, look at the whole picture. But when I was writing for the newspaper, I was proud that of all few years, only once did I have to put a retraction in. And that was because a paragraph got lost in the printer. Somebody said, we need a hole, and they fixed it. And I said, don't ever do that again. I said, you know. But that was when I was to start just using cold type. Yeah, I go back far enough to remember Linotype. My first newspaper was in Linotype. If you never heard of Linotype machine, just listen to it. Find a place and listen to it. The noise is deafening. But the people who put those things together were brilliant men and women.
Yeah,
oh, by the way, you said I'm in Raleigh. I'm in Atlanta. I'm based in Atlanta.
Something I got to ask. I'm sorry, I wanted to just kind of drop this in there. You were talking about you know, these people, especially when they're talking in public, especially during a poll thing, they got, you know, we know they've had teleprompters for a while, stuff like that. And every now and again, they go off script and they say something unique in the middle of it that kind of jacks them, or they read it wrong while they're trying to read the crowd, stuff like that. I get it that speech is not a bad thing, but, right, the individual statements that they make when they don't realize they're being recorded in that, those to me have more value and are much more real and are actually them.
I agree.
The reference that even Obama would do those things, when working the teleprompter and that. But, man, you know, when Obama didn't know he was on camera and was talking about people going to guns and going to religion and that was very much his real opinion. Because that was his crowd there when he was talking, just as an example. I'm sure we can get a million of them, you know, left, right, and otherwise. So, but just...
My thing is this. I remember when America, when they could disagree with each other, and go ahead and have a beer afterward. I remember when you have Mac Mathias. He was Republican, liberal as hell. And you had conservatives in the Democratic Party. Let me tell you about one man that no one knows about. He was a congressman from Baltimore County, Maryland, named Clarence D. Long, Dr. Clarence D. Long. And I remember I see him all the time. He was part of my district, the newspaper. And one time walked into his office, and he was screaming, I mean screaming at his staff. But he had a rule. From the moment a letter came in the mail, they had 5 days to respond to it. Five or six days to respond to it. You say, let them know that something's being done. And then and periodically tell them what's going on so they make sure it's being done. And I said, he was upset because the letter got misplaced, and he was angry. And I said, Dr. Long, I said, he was a Democrat. I said, but Dr. Long, maybe he's a Republican. He looked at me, and he said, Bill, I know you're joking, but I'll be very honest with you. I don't have any Republicans in my district. What? I don't have any Democrats. I've got constituents. I don't give a damn who they voted for. I give a damn that it's my job to work for them. They are my people, Republican, Democrat, or whatever. My job is constituent service. My job is to serve the people who elected me.
Boy, that's a lost art.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, whoa. I mean, he was, yep. I mean, and he was a gentleman, but he was a nice guy. I mean, he was like, I mean, he was a, I admired him because he said, and I said, I'm, and he, you know, he said, don't put it in the newspaper. I'm not here to get you to see how wonderful I am. What do you need, Bill? what's the problem? So he wasn't expecting me to push in there. He said, what do you need me for? And he sat down talking to me for 15, 20 minutes. But, you know, but he cared about the people of the election, I mean, of his district. And he did. And again, he was a guy who voted for what he thought was best for the country and best for his district. You know, a lost art now.
There's not enough people out there that are willing to make up their own minds, and there's too many people out there now that listen to particular celebrities or, you know, particular personalities and immediately go, I'm going to think like that, because that's what they think, and you know, that's instead of formulating their own. And every story has two sides, and despite myself being a conservative, there are things that I will tell you I would probably be a little more moderate, if not liberal, thinking towards. There are some things that I feel that perhaps we make too big of a deal on, and we're spinning our wheels by talking about it. And I go all the time about pot. I never smoked pot in my life. I'll be turning 50 here in another 2 months. Never touched this stuff. But we're at a point in our society right now where it's just not that big of a deal. You pull a guy over and he's got good tags. He's got a clean record. He's got a clean driving record. You know, when you run his tags, everything is clean, clean, clean. You flip open his console and you find the dime bag in there. Oh my God. Oh Jesus. This guy's got to go to the chair. You know,
yeah.
There's so many worse things going on. Are we still having a debate over pot? And the reason why I mention that is because 100 years ago, we were going through something called prohibition. And it was the same thing with alcohol. And now, here we are 100 years later, you know, Budweiser is headlining the Super Bowl, the World Series, and everything else. I mean, they got Clydesdales. You've got, you know, Jack Daniels having tours. You can buy, you know, full barrels for $10,000 with your name on it, for crying out loud. So, you know, there are certain things that I feel like we spin our wheels with. But the problem for me is that a lot of times I think the press, I wish we could find a source out there that would give an unskewed, and that was the thing about guys like Frank Reynolds and Walter Cronkite and those guys. They were liberal-minded guys, but when they spoke the news, they read the news. And well, I remember black and white.
I remember Frank Reynolds. One thing I remember him when Reagan was shot, and the word came out that Brady was dead. And Reynolds said, wait a minute, Press Secretary James Brady has also died. What? Wait. He's not. Damn it!
Yeah, stop. I remember. Well, somebody,
he can criticize, but I'm thinking, that's the kind of journalism you want. When you're, damn it, I want the truth. But, verify your information before you give it to me. I mean, that's the kind of man you want there. We'll
right.
fight for the truth.
Well, and there's a couple things in what you guys have said there. Keep in mind, it wasn't like one guy gathered all the news for all the stuff and then got on camera and did it. That was talking about the quality of the staffs, that, you know, from the people doing the digging to the people that, you know, right, cleaning it up to get it, you know, to getting it ready for the air, to the people doing the editing, to the, you know, the quality control, the whole nine yards. There were people, well, there was quality in the control there that they were, you know, they were getting the truth and, you know, they were getting the reality and they were reporting it. And it was definitely... they were reporting the news and trying to keep it not opinion news.
Well, let me tell you something. Here's something. I lived in Belfast, Northern Ireland, back in 72 and 73 at the height of the Troubles.
Yeah.
And they had three newspapers there. And let me, as when I learned about reading newspapers and knowing what to believe or not. Here's a hypothetical situation. Hypothetical. The British Army learns or is reported that there's a house in a Catholic area has a lot of bomb-making equipment and ammunition. Based on that information, they stage a raid on the house. During the raid, two people inside the house are killed, and they find a lot of bomb-making equipment and ammunition. Those are the facts. The facts. The Irish News says, two Catholic defenders murdered as Brits raid house. The newsletter says, two terrorists killed as Army raids IRA ammo dump. The Telegraph says, two die during Army raid, large arms cache seized. Who lied? Not one.
Yeah.
As Cervantes says, facts are the enemy of truth. Truth is an opinion. Truth is an interpretation of facts. When you know the facts and believe the facts, then you make up your own truth.
Right. And one more thing.
That's a really excellent example because that's a, you know, where it comes down to is if you're trying to report something, are you being free with your emotion and your interpretation, or are you trying to get to the actual reality? Are you getting to the reality? Are you using your reality?
Right.
And we don't have that now. I do want to take a couple steps back here because you touched on something that we often refer to here as being butthurt. Talking about people that can have different opinions and stuff like that and go out and have a beer afterwards or whatever. But people today, man, they not only get butthurt easily, they stay butthurt. And that's just just so you know, Bill, that's been a common conversation on this show.
Well, here recently on Yahoo News, now granted, I always read the Yahoo News just because it's so skewed and everything. It's entertaining. But if you recall, at the end of last week, beginning of this week, the Dow dropped like 800 points. And for two or three days straight, we kept hearing about a term called a corrective economy. And I'm going, okay, for a guy who follows the economy the way I do, what in the hell is a collective economy? Okay? So basically what they were saying is that Trump, being who he is before he was president, that all the Trumpish guys in the country have more or less gotten together and run the Dow up unnecessarily on his watch. In other words, they're taking advantage of him being in office. And I kind of scratched my head and I says, well, kind of like when Clinton was in office and all the banks were doing all kinds of sketchy stuff with signing out mortgages to E5s in the Marine Corps and that kind of jazz, you know, $300,000 home loans to E5s in the military and everything. I says, and the Dow went up on Clinton's watch, but then it took a nosedive when they put a stop to that stuff and they blame Bush on it, you know? So is that the same type of corrective economy you're speaking of? So lo and behold, all this, you know, how low does it have to go to be a bear market? Start thinking about buying. This is the end, blah, blah, blah. Well, the last 2 days, if you haven't noticed, the Dow is closed 1,200 plus points, 2 days in a row up. And there has yet to be one damn mention of it. And
yes, very, very little. Yep. They love the doom and gloom, brother.
Yep. And that's the point I'm getting at right there. For the average person who doesn't have the wherewithal to educate themselves, as Rush would call low information voter, the person who reads a headline, believes it, moves on with their life, they're still thinking, oh, my God, my 401k is going to go to hell. When the fact is, the Dow has picked up.
I agree with you, but the problem is this. Is the media has gone down tremendously through the years. The thing is, when Obama was in office, CNN basically said he could do no wrong, and Fox felt Obama could do no right. Now we've got the Fox saying Trump can't do no wrong, and CNN says Trump can't do no right. The problem is, whatever happened is people saying this is good, this is good. Hey, this is bad. You know, we had honest and fair coverage. I mean,
right.
When you feel like Fox is never going to say anything against Trump. That's as bad as CNN never said anything good about him. I mean, I when I watch the news, I don't even watch the news. I read as many different sites as I can. I don't read pro-Trump. I don't read anti-Trump. I read them all to try to figure out what the hell is actually happening, because we've polarized our country so much. There are certain people Trump could do something really brilliant. And people say, well, he's doing it for his own good, blah, blah, blah. And of course, CNN will say, well, it's blah, 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 negative, negative. Fox said, hey, it's wonderful. And then Trump could do something really horrendous, like blow a hole in a street or something like that. We're like, oh, my God, it's terrible. Fox would find a way to excuse him. CNN was like, see, we're right. I'm thinking, whatever happened to honesty, fairness, giving us as much information on both sides as we possibly can. We're always hearing one side from one side. When I was in a war correspondent, I had friends on all sides. I had British soldier friends. I had IRA friends. I had Protestant militant friends. I got shot 3 times, grave wounds, but I count them. I escaped a couple of assassination attempts. They're not called drive-by shootings, but they call it assassination attempts. It's classy. But I took the risk and did everything I could to present the facts, the information I could. I'm now working on a one-man show about my time in Northern Ireland, about all the various things on both sides. But the problem was, we don't have people who give a fuck about both sides. We have a person who's like, I love Donald Trump, or I hate Donald Trump. And that's what we hear. We don't hear the truth about Donald Trump. Well, no, we hear their truth, but not the facts.
And that's just it. And, you know, like I said, unfortunately, there's a contingent of people out there who don't take the time to stop and say, okay, perhaps this is skewed to the right, this is skewed to the left. I need to read on. I need to make up my own mind. And unfortunately, and without getting on my soapbox, this whole thing with Bernie Sanders right now, by God, if I thought that, and this is what I'm getting at. The other night he said something about the minimum wage, that he would run the minimum wage up to $15 across the board. Okay, across the nation, minimum wage would be $15 an hour. All right. So when the follow-up question was, well, how would you fund that? And he mentioned a 52% tax, payroll tax. Okay. So if you do the math, $15 times 40 hours a week, okay, and then you back off the 52% payroll tax, you would be making $7.20 an hour. All right.
Well, I hate people like you. They figure these things out.
I'm not a genius by any stretch of imagination, but I do have a calculator, and I did spend the day on last night at the Holiday Inn Express. But to the, again, low information voter, and as much as I don't like to agree with Rush, I think he's a little too far right. He does have a very good point when he uses the term low information voter, because they hear Bernie say $15 and the light bulb fades in and out over their head, because all they hear is the money. Now, let me add on to this. Bernie, while he's talking about making the national minimum wage $15 an hour, all right, since Trump's been in and brought more jobs on, he has forced these corporations, i.e., the Waltons and the big dogs of the world that are you know, got making ungodly amount of money and have a workforce full of minimum wage people. He, by expanding the job market, he is forcing the hand of these corporations to up their pay standards just to get the decent help. So he's not legislating anything. He's not making a law. He's not saying that, hey, you know, you have to pay somebody this. He's created jobs, and by supply and demand, so to speak, in the workforce, now if you're an employer and you want somebody worth a damn working for you, you can't pay them minimum wage. And it really doesn't make a damn what minimum wage is, because you, as an employer that wants good people, will always up the ante. And I think I might have mentioned this on the show a couple weeks ago, where the restaurant Crystal, that
yep.
used to be like a White Castle, they actually
yeah.
filed for Chapter 11 protection. And the CEO got on, and he said, due to all of the wage increases and the competitive job market, we have not been able to afford to get better help. And the better and having the lower end help has not helped us drive sales, so we're having to file for Chapter 11. So I'm reading this thing and I'm going, okay, well, out of the mouth of the CEO, he's basically saying, I can't shit on my employees and keep this thing afloat. So for me, my business plan to keep things afloat is to treat people or to work people to death for the lowest wage possible. And now that the job market has become more competitive and I have to up the wages to keep good help, I can't afford to stay in business. You know what? The hell with you then. You know, you need to fold. It's the corporations like you that need to get tits up. So, you know, again, it's another one of those ones that, you know, I don't find myself to be a genius, But for a guy like me,
don't worry, no one will ever accuse you of being a genius.
Well, there's a few out there, but the bottom line is, you know, you dig, you read, you formulate your opinion, and again, numbers don't lie. I actually heard what Bernie said, and I said, wow, that would be cool if everybody was able to make that across the board. That would be fantastic. But then I sat down and started doing the math, and I said, well, hot damn, that ain't going to do anybody any good. It's going to put them further back.
Well, I I've been following politics for a long time. I actually, during the campaign, I met Barry Goldwater. Those of you actually know who the hell he was.
Been a
little bit.
But the thing is, politicians have one thing in common. They're great with promises and lean on action.
That's true.
A politician's promise is when I hear a politician's promise, I think of Mary Poppins. Because here she's in a fantasy world, but once she says, that's a pie crust promise, easily made, easily broken. That's what a politician's promise is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good call.
You ready for a minor context switch?
Sure.
Bill, you talked about Northern Ireland being there with the trouble, stuff like that. I was actually visiting Ireland in 76 and happened to miss a bus that ended up going boom as far as that stuff. So I've seen some of that. I was there for the All World in Dublin.
Okay.
It might actually have been 77, been a minute, so I'm, you know, trying to remember. But, the guys on the show kind of know the story, maybe not, some of the details on it. So, growing up doing the Irish dancing in Ireland, and being able to compete over there, one of the families I got close with was from Canada. And the dad, he was friggin' awesome. He grew up in Northern Ireland speaking Gaelic, yeah? So he comes to Canada, and of course his English that he's learning, he's bringing his own accent to it. He's learning the Canadian English, grammatically more correct than ours, mind you. And hell of a good guy. But he wore dentures, right? And he was the old school kind of guy that it's everything for the family and the kids first. So
right.
I will not replace these bad fitting dentures that hurt my mouth because there's things my kids need, right? You know, it's just
right.
Old school. And of course, you know, he'd imbibe a few or whatever during the weekend, during the Irish dancing, stuff like that. And, it was only when he got mad when we didn't understand him and he'd start cursing us out over something that we could actually understand him. And it just made me laugh. You know, he was a hell of a guy. He really was. He was a pseudo dad growing up for me. That was an old, you know, that just, I have my own unique Northern Ireland connections. In fact, I've got some Tullamore Dew in my cupboard. I was just eyeballing it, thinking about it. So if you're familiar with Tullamore Dew, that dude turned me on to that. And actually, I turned Dave on to some Tullamore Dew.
Yeah, that is damn good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So you got part of my Northern Ireland story there. You know, part of the background, you know a real piece about me with that. But, yeah, old Bob McKay, he was a hell of a guy. Yeah. I used to actually, my dance school competed against his son's dance school, and Sean and I are still fast friends to this day. We've known each other since 70, 71, somewhere around there.
Okay.
So that That been a damn minute.
My time in Northern Ireland, about 6 months ago, I was doing something on YouTube, and I was looking, and I saw it was a BBC documentary on about Bloody Friday. The IRA planted 19 bombs in Belfast. They all went off in an hour, July 21st, 1972. And they had this documentary on it about it, so I figured, let me watch it. I'm watching with my wife, and I'm thinking, and I said, let me go back and watch that section again. Why? See this thing where this bomb is, see that bread van down there? Yep. Watch what happens. Kaboom, okay? That car was overturned? Yep. That's where my apartment was. Right across the street from the bread van. And it was like one of those things of, you know, by escaping death. I would go to the pub, like, you know, you would go to the pub at night, have a drink, talk about politics and whatever else, and the ladies, whatever. And I would usually sleep from 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That was my nap time. That was my siesta. But. And for some reason, I got back late. So it was 2:15. I mean, usually by the time I'm dead asleep, no pun intended. I get this Peeler police officer, RUC, comes blind on the door. He goes, get out, there's a bomb. I said, is this a real turkey or is it just a hoax? You see that bread van? Clear the building. So I grabbed my tape recorder and my camera, ran out of the building. I cleared the building first, make sure everybody was gone. And about 30 minutes later, the bomb went off. So therefore, now the BBC has an actual video of the bomb going off. So I'm going, but it sort of reminded me that how life is precious. And if I had gone to bed at my normal time, I'd be dead now.
Wow. Yeah, how about that?
We can't have that, Bill.
You know, the thing is, we forget how precious life is. And when we get into these damn arguments over bullshit because somebody's politics is something else, it's like, really? You're going to diss that person because he likes Trump and you don't? Or he likes Obama and you don't? I mean, there are other things. I mean, look. When I had a near-death experience. And I had an auto accident December 20th, 2015. On Christmas Day, I had a near-death experience. And I'm going to tell you, if you're going to have a near-death experience, do it on Christmas Day. Be like Ebenezer Scrooge and George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life. It's a magical moment. Hey, I have a near-death on Christmas Day. Hey, that's cool. I had people come in. But I had people come in to visit me, and I know one person in particular was very strong Donald Trump. That person was very strong Hillary Clinton. And the great thing about it was they came there to talk to me, not politics, talk about theater. And I'm thinking, if these people knew how they felt, they'd hate each other. But because we're not talking politics, they're a friend. And I'm thinking, this is the way life should be.
It is, and it's way too often that too many people, I can't even go into a gas station locally here without somebody bringing it up, and you'll have two people in a line spit-spatting over nonsense, and both of them, you know, it's usually just opinions back and forth. So, I understand that 100%. And
yeah.
It's everywhere you go, and it's getting worse in a lot of aspects, but in a lot of aspects, it's gotten better in some ways. People's...
Well, the thing is, I found it fascinating. I was in Europe during the election. And I was doing a film over there. And I checked my likes and dislikes on my Facebook page. About 55% of my friends like Donald Trump. And about 45% of my friends like Hillary Clinton. So it's pretty much even. I'm thinking, here, these people are my friends. They have no idea how I feel. But I don't put my politics on my Facebook page. And the thing was, when I left, I didn't have a chance to vote in the elections. I didn't expect to be over in Europe at the time. But I didn't, my wife and I couldn't vote. It was too hard to ask me about it. We didn't expect to be over there. But the interesting thing was, when people look at this country, people have no idea how the world views us. But when we had a fly out of Barcelona to Istanbul and back to the United States, and I went to customs leaving Barcelona. Now they open your bag. Oh, United States. Go ahead, keep your bag closed. God bless you. Good luck for praying for you. It happened both in Barcelona and in Istanbul, because they didn't know what we're getting. We didn't know, but that the people care about this country. God bless you. Good luck for praying for you. Sometimes I wish people were here would think that. Pray for this country.
That is correct.
Well, we're sending so much foreign aid to these. I mean, not only financial support, but whenever somebody, when it comes down to, and I speak on it often, whenever somebody keels over somewhere on the planet that's important, moving on a plane, and where do they fly them to? They fly them to the States to get treatment. You see guys out burning United States flags, and they're wearing Nike T-shirts. Where do you think that came from? It always befuddles me to see these guys, you know, doing the anti-American stuff, and they're wearing New York Yankees hats and that kind of jazz. But the thing of it is that the United States not only is a financial importance, but it's also a security importance. It's an economic importance. So that's why it's another thing for me, for a lot of these countries that try to root against us. I'm thinking, you know what, you know, go ahead. And we always say, you know, I don't like this guy, I don't like that guy. To be honest with you, I don't want to like a president. I want to respect the president. And
there it is.
And, you know, if a president makes – that guy's got to make some hard-ass decisions. And not only does he have to make it for the 400 million people living in the United States, but he also has to make it on a global aspect. And,
well,
here's
the problem. We want – when we elect people, we want them to be pure and innocent and perfect. I mean, someone like Ben Franklin, he couldn't be elected president nowadays. So many things he did, people are like, oh my God, that's terrible. I'm thinking, I don't give a shit about that kind of stuff. I want a man or a woman who knows what they're doing, who cares about the country more than they care about themselves.
Yuppers.
Absolutely.
Hey, guys, I hate to do this. We're tracking on, and this is a really good example. Bill, I know you didn't realize this. Next thing you know, you got on the show, and I know we had a couple things in our IMs the other day that we wanted to talk about. But you see how when you get on the show, you sit down, and it's like sitting at a table and just talking with some mates?
Yeah.
You know, the only thing we're not doing is actually breaking bread together. So just my opinion, you are more than welcome back whenever you want. But what I would like to do is see if you could tell us about some of the projects that you got going on and stuff like that, because we're a little bit past 10 o'clock. And I'd like to hear about some of the projects you got going on. And I understand your wife has a bunch of stuff going on, so we'd like to hear about that if possible. I just want to, you know, try to get to the advertising portion of the show, if you will.
Thank you.
You see how we could have gone right past that without trying, though, right?
Well, you're a gentleman. You're fun, and you listen, and we talk. We have a discussion. We have a conversation rather than saying talking at each other. We're talking with each other.
Correct.
We're hanging out.
Yes. Guys, I do Ben Franklin, and if somebody wants me to do a Ben Franklin at their school or their business or whatever, I have about 50 topics I discuss with them. My thing is, I don't do my Ben Franklin. I do the Ben Franklin they want me to do. Somebody says, I'm on Ben Franklin, but don't talk about God. Okay, I don't talk about God. They say, talk about God. Okay, I'll talk about God. Don't mention this. I'll mention, okay, I won't mention that. Please talk about these little things. So I will devise the script based on what they want. Now, everything I say is factual. I don't invent stuff. I mean, there are some quotes I create based on the stories. For example, like when he went to leave his brother's tyrannical dictatorship as an apprentice, you know, he talked about Franklin in his autobiography, talked about going to the ship and that, well, I had to sell all my books for passage. Then as I approached the vessel, I realized I had another problem. If the captain knew I was leaving an apprenticeship, I could be jailed. I could bar me for the court and my dreams would vanish. So I had to lie. Bach, young man, why are you heading to New York? Well, you see, sir, Captain Lordship, sir, I got a girl in trouble. Oh, come aboard, lad, come aboard. Now, you know, he said, I had to tell the captain that I got a girl in trouble. Obviously, my dialogue was interpreted, but it's still based on what he said, that he told the captain he got a girl in trouble, and that's how he got a passage to leave New York, to leave Boston. So I do the story, whatever they want. I mean, they won't be any surprise. I mean, I might go through the whole section, but they understand. So they're not surprised. If I mention something they don't want to mention, it won't happen. Right? I mean, I'll do it in schools, elementary schools. But everything is accurate. My wife does Mrs. Ben Franklin. She also does a woman called Mary Ann Harris Gay, a lady who survived George Sherman's Urban Renewal Project in Atlanta, General Sherman Urban Renewal Project in Atlanta in 1864. So she talks about this woman based on the woman's writings and other information. But she talks about how this woman survived the Civil War. I do shows about the troubles in Northern Ireland, and again, accurate, based on facts, based on my observations. I met Jerry Adams before he was while he was still a terrorist. I have a lot of diaries written up, I write my book about Ireland. My information on Ireland, I guess, was stuck in the corner, and my wife said, "Why don't you get out your stuff and finish your book about Ireland?" So I will.
Hold on, Bob. You know, you touch on a book and you're running past it. Give us a moment on, you know, you're working on a book, man. You got, I hate to say it, I might be pressuring you. Do you have an actual timeline? Is this something you're really working on hard? Because you may not know it, but Dave is an author as well. Working on things. You know, Dr. John has got some stuff published as well. Kind of give us a little context for the book. And, you know, again, this is your advertising time. You've got the platform here. Let's give you a little love, brother.
I'm figuring it's going to take me about a year to put it together. I think of all my old notes that have been scattered around this house. But I want to make sure it's accurate because I discovered one thing. What I remembered and what actually happened were two different things. I have a diary. And I looked at my diary and said, the diary was more accurate than my information. The diary was written the day that the incident happened. So I'm making sure it's accurate. It talks about the people in Ireland. It talks about some of the scary shit I went through. And it talks about, you know, about the kids and all that. It talks about a thing called the Lollipop Patrol, which is basically a army squad that kept the Protestant and Catholic school students from killing each other. There was one time I was working at a filling station, and we heard the sound. And my district manager was there, and he goes, "It sounded like I don't want to do this; it hurts your ears." But it's like, really, it's like if somebody's taking a cat and scratching it, And my boss said, "Good God, that sounds like a bloody banshee. I haven't heard one of those in, before you can say the word, years." A bomb went off. He killed a soldier. And you can't make this shit up. I mean, it sounded like very, and for example, when my apartment got blown up, the tape was running, and the guy, a French journalist, was talking to me. He was asking, "How long you been here?" Blah blah blah. And he said, "My comment was, I have a flat." Well, at the moment, before I get the word "moment" out, the bomb went off. It's wearing my flat, and that's on tape. So I'm also writing a couple of scripts. I am in the process of writing a sequel to Christmas Carol, in which the people say
You touched on that yesterday, and I was kind of curious about how you wanted to go about that.
Well, what we're doing is Scrooge is basically, for a lot of me crazy, but he's giving money away, and there's one quote in there, one line when one of the scoundrels says, "Sounds like he's in touch with religion. Business and religion can't work together." I'm going, ooh. Because if you care about people, if you care about people more than you care about money, that's dangerous. These are scoundrels. These are evil people, and they're saying that, not the good guys.
No, I'm following the. That's just kind of cool because, let's face it, the story kind of ends right after the epiphany. So I was,
right. Well, basically,
interpret it.
Right. To me, what part of my thing is, and I hope to have this done within a month. Basically, the idea is, no matter how terrible somebody is, they can still be saved. I one time trying to explain to people different things. When I did a one man Scrooge. I did a one man Scrooge also at a school, at a public school, seventh grade. And this one kid said, "I don't like Christmas Carol. Why? We don't believe in ghosts and spirits." I go, "I understand that. Who's Marley?" "What? Who's Marley?" "I sat beside you many a day. Why you see me now, I cannot say." "Who's this beside you many a day?" "Your guardian angel." "Christmas past. Look at what you've done. How can you make amends? Treat people like you want to be treated. Jesus. Christmas present. You're not listening to me, God." And the Holy Spirit guides you in your future choices without saying a word, guides you. "Oh, yeah, you're right. I don't believe in spirits either." And the student looked at me. She says, "I never thought of it like that before." I go, "Think about that now." I said, I've been doing Scrooge for years. I'm doing one man Scrooge now. And it just seemed to be a friend of mine helping me. He gave me a story about Scrooge's, sequel. And I'm taking his short story and I'm expanding it. We talk about redemption and Scrooge being a good guy. And there are a lot of interesting things involved there. So I don't want to give away too much. But I'm hoping to have it done by the end of March.
Oh, very nice. I think kind of cool. Yeah, I know you're trying to bring more to the table, but one of my thoughts here is I kind of want to get, because you're talking about the stuff, you're talking about writing, you're talking about acting, and we got a writer and we got an actor right here on the show with us, Dave and Kevin, the guys, do you got some questions? Because now, you're hearing some different input. I get the feeling I know Dave probably has technical questions from the, you know, the reporter editor type background, bringing that into the writing. And I'm going to guess Kevin has some creative juices flowing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Most definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. You can go with, you know, and especially a tale like that one, you know, and it's a very good point. Nobody ever tells the good side of that story. It's all, I'm not going to say it's bad, but it's all the learning part of it. And you never get to see the real impact, because it's funny, every adaptation that you see of A Christmas Carol, the last 2 minutes is Scrooge walking around hugging everybody, throwing gold pieces around, and then they roll the credits. What did it do to Bob Cratchit? How did it affect Tiny Tim? You know, how did it affect the town?
But Dave, stop. Did it not happen that way?
Well, and if Bill gets to work on this, we're going to find out. That's what makes it so damned intriguing, is because it is. It's something that it doesn't have a definitive end to it. You know what I mean? And there's more to be told. So, yeah, I think that's genius. Great idea.
Yeah,
I think it's also – and also, I have a setup that Scrooge, by being a kinder, gentler Scrooge, actually he's making more money.
Yeah, he's actually profiting himself better by being kind.
Yes.
Imagine that.
I mean, there's one line in there is like, you know, you don't profit by putting a man in debtor's prison.
Well, I've always said that the one thing in life people say all the time about what's the meaning of life, to me, it's all about leaving the world in a little bit better shape than what you got it. And it doesn't take you finding the cure for cancer. It doesn't take you, saving a dozen children from a burning building. It takes you being that kind of person that holds doors open for somebody. You know,
well, you have something. When I had my near death on Christmas Day, 2015, I woke up and my lung collapsed. I had to put emergency chest tube in, and I started breathing again. It was like one of the things, like, you know, weird things happening, and the white room with the black box going down. So it was, you know, one of those, like, your traditional near death experiences. And I woke up. And I said out, just saying it, you know, here it is, it's Christmas week, and my family isn't here. But I have these friends who are spending their time Christmas week, but they should be with their family. It's really nice. And the nurse said, or some a female voice said, Mr. Pacer, you're wrong. These people are not your friends. You're right. They should be with their family this week. Now, I don't know who the hell you are. But we had about 100 people come to visit you here while you're in here. That's more than most celebrities have. But you're wrong. These people are not your friends. They're your family. That's why they're with you. And then one woman came in and said, Bill, do you remember me? I go, yeah, yes, such and such is mom. Yes. My daughter wanted me to come in, and I wanted to meet, so I'll tell you thank you. But for what? Well, she was in Christmas Carol with me. Her dog was in Christmas Carol with me about 6 or 7 years earlier. And the girl was drop-dead gorgeous. She was beautiful. She looked like she was about 25. So I'm asking her questions at school in the morning. Oh, what's your major? She goes, oh, I'm in seventh grade. I go, okay. I immediately summoned. I said, all men in the dressing room now. Gentlemen. You're like, oh, gosh, you know, they're talking about it. I said, gentlemen, he's 13 years old. Oh, my God. Thank you. Thank you. And so there's other kids, about 19, walked in, and they told me, you know, leave her alone. She's too young. So I said, you don't leave him alone. Me and her other dad, her five other daddies would beat the fucking shit out of you. But one of the other dads went and told the mom. 8 years later, she comes back and thanks me. I said, because to me, it's like, you know, as guys realize that from being dirty old men and being fathers, and they protected her. And the moms came back to tell me thank you. And that was, I mean, I didn't think of anything other. I think it's, you know, it's just my job to protect my family, my people. And I said that she thought I'd come back, and that was the only time I've seen her. And, you know, it's things like that when you don't realize what you've accomplished, what people think about you, remember you. We always think that, you know, no one's going to remember me, no one's going to forget. But the things we do, how we affect other people, we never know how we affect other people. But we know how other people affect us. And if we care about others, then others will care about us too.
Right. Yeah, it's about, you know, in many ways, excuse me, I know I'm going to use an archaic reference. If you remember the old Breck commercial, it used to be about I tell two friends and they tell two friends and they tell two friends, that kind of thing.
Right.
And the screen would fill up with people. If we can do that little thing where we do those little impacts in life, by setting a good example, doing the right thing the right way for the right reason. And I admit, I do it very roughly around the edges. Not the most articulate, definitely protocol. Yeah, I don't get that crap. The you know, all that stuff. But if we can, you know, just try to do some of those things, do some of those little impacts, and make some of those little changes, you know, teach our offspring a few more things than we knew. And, you know, friends and family and all that, then we've done good. I just want to, you know, personally, I want to walk off with my slate saying I did more good than wrong, because Lord knows we get a lot of shit wrong just from not knowing. I mean, we all know that, what's the old phrase? I'm sure I'm going to get it wrong. Something about, bad experiences come from lack of wisdom. And wisdom comes from bad experiences. That's the old way it is. You know, so if we can kind of share that little stuff, kind of save somebody a little pain along the way, give a little love, that kind of stuff. You know, they say love can be seen as the answer, but, you know, you just give a little bit, you know. Just give a little bit.
Yeah.
You got to give more than you take.
Yes.
For sure you did.
Dr. John, you there, brother?
Absolutely, I'm here. I've been listening to all the stuff.
It's 24 after. I'm thinking it's time for us to take our lessons from Papa Stroh.
And do our plugs.
That's what I was thinking.
That's exactly right. Okay, well, I'm going to start, and I'm going to say I don't have one, because I have a couple of ideas I'm going to expound on and try to put them together for Pop Culture Stars. So I'm going to defer to everyone else. Now, how's that?
Excellent.
Okay.
Well, I'll hold here a second.
It's been an eye-opener tonight. It really has been. Bill, I will say this as my
parents
for being with us. And you know what? We want to have you back again sooner than later. Can we do that?
I hear you now.
What?
I didn't hear you for a while. I know. I hear you again.
He's saying he would love to have you back sooner than later, brother.
Yeah, we want to have you back sooner than later. I've been sitting here taking all this in, and I have been processing
and coming up with some things that I want to do thanks to having Bill Pacer on. So, absolutely.
Sure, anytime, anytime. I love it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, now, Todd, I'm going to turn it right back at you. What's your plug tonight?
Man, you know what? I can't let this one out of the bag. I'm going to have to bury a particular plug for the moment. I'll hit you guys privately.
Okay.
This is what I'm going to go with. Guys, Pop Culture Stars is sitting here. I know we kind of sort of had an agenda sitting there with things on some of the messages yesterday, that kind of stuff, day before. But here's the thing. It's a great example of how we get a guest on the show, Bill Pacer in this particular case. We have Kevin Holland back. And next thing you know, we're sitting here just talking. And the little things that were kind of like some points we wanted to get to, it just kind of got sidetracked because we were just hanging around at a table. So I got to tell you, there are worse things in life than being able to come out on Wednesday night and hang out, talk with people, and actually have a lot of honest, real freaking fun, meet people, discuss things, share things. And it is so fun that it proves we're unscripted, because the little things we want to talk about, we kind of had to stop and try to make a point of. We had already been well past an hour before we even got to it. So that's awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. That is a great plug. Yay, that well. What kind of a plug do you have?
Well, you know, having Bill on here is a perfect fit for what I wanted to mention. As I had, again, being the guy who self-educates, I had read something yesterday how they had gone around and surveyed certain particular college campuses here in the United States. And I'm not talking community colleges or vocational schools. I'm talking the high-dollar, high-end, very prestigious universities we have. And they ask college students questions about Civil War, about the Holocaust, about World War II, about, recent events and everything going on. And amazingly enough, that there wasn't, the Holocaust take, for instance, there was only a 38% success rate on the Holocaust. Okay, when I say a 38% success rate, it's basically saying that they were able to acknowledge it and speak on it. Not go into detail, just to speak on it. So perhaps if we quit tearing down history, maybe we can remember what the hell it was about. So, God bless Bill Pacer, what he's doing, bringing back a genius like Ben Franklin. And because that man, he shaped the country, and had that thing not panned out the way they would, he'd end up on the business end of a rope. So, well done, sir. Appreciate you having on tonight.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Kevin Holland, what do you have to say tonight to wrap up?
Are you there?
Kevin, you there, brother? You muted?
Uh-oh. The zombies got him.
The zombies got him. Well, that's okay. We're getting back again. Now, I have been listening to some wonderful conversations. I got to tell you guys something funny. I never got to ask my question at 9:27 tonight, which is, how was Mark Twain and how were Benjamin Franklin a lot alike? So I never got to ask that question. So, Bill Pacer, can I ask you that the next time we have you on?
Yeah, I miss. Who do you compare me to? Franklin and who?
I'm sorry, say that again, sir.
Compare me to Franklin. Who was the other person you asked about? Franklin and who?
Franklin and Mark Twain.
Oh, okay, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting comparison, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll get to that because I know the British lady is getting ready to sing. And I want to thank everybody for being on tonight's episode of Pop Culture Stars. And we'll be back next week, Bill Pacer. We're going to have you on sooner than later. And thanks to everybody. Dave, is the fat lady ready to sing?
Right on. Sounds good. I'm here at the ready.
All right.
Remember, doing good for man is doing good for God.
And we'll see you
outstanding.
Guys next week on Pop Culture Stars. Take care.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good call.